This is Nancy Qualls Corbett, April 10th, 1992, Our Body, Our Soul.
Friday, April 10, 1992, Nancy Qualls Corbett, author of The Sacred Prostitute, speaks on Our Body, Our Soul.
Tonight I want to talk about our body, our soul. Actually, we're talking a lot about, when we talk about body, we're going to be talking about matter, too. But also how they don't have to, yep. Okay. How's this? Okay, everybody? Okay. We want to see how the body can give life to soul, how soul gives life to body. And we talk so much about the psyche-soma split, but I think once we begin to understand what we do to body, what we do to soul, rather than what we do for body and what we do for soul, then maybe there's some way that we can begin to bring these two more closely united so that we have a sense of the wholeness or the totality of our being. So when we think of our body, that just marvelous, intricate network of bones and blood vessels and nerves and muscles and organs and so forth, we think of that truly. It's that aspect of ourselves with which we most identify. When we're asked to describe ourselves, you know, we say, well, you know, we're 5'9", medium weight, blonde hair, blue eyes, you see. It's our body that gives us our identity. We think of it in that way. We spend countless hours exercising it, feeding it, lots of money, beautifying it, adorning it. And in our collective conscious life, we are bombarded with advertisements of the latest diet or health foods, the latest beauty treatments, exercise regime, all of that, cosmetic surgery, you know, even age spot removers, balding, lotions, all of it. If we consider the billions of dollars that we spend each year on the body, we could consider it a national obsession. To be fit and healthy is one response, but this obsession seems to surpass that tremendously. Our primary response to the body appears that it must be beautiful, youthful, and sexually attractive. I mean, we can look at any magazine counter where bust size or bicep size are just in prevalent pictures all over the place, you see. And if we do not see these qualities in our own mirror, then we worry about our self-image and become even more determined to exercise more strenuously or diet more rigorously, or then we rush to the clinics for a complete overhaul job of some sort. See, in truth, we do not like our natural body, only our body image with which we identify. We strive for a more perfect image in order to build up little egos or to cover our lack of connection to our inner life. We cover up our natural body smells We are embarrassed by our natural body's sounds. And the natural body response of desires and emotions have to be suppressed or denied. Have you ever given thought to what a marvelous feat of nature blushing is? You see, millions of little tiny red blood cells rush against all gravitational force, you see, because some wonderful emotion has created this thing, you see. Or given thought to when our eyes tear up, even spill over, because something quite beautiful has touched us, whether it's a friend's kiss or magic moments of some kind, you see. Or the chill bumps that our body receives when some beautiful music strain or some lyric poetry or just the sunrise covers us, you see. Our body wants to tell us these things. Our body wants us to say, look. And so it gives us these body responses. But sometimes these natural reactions are usually a source of embarrassment because they belie our body image. Our instinctive nature or our animal part. That's what our body is. Dr. Jung wrote, when we say the animal in man, this always strikes us as something horrible. But this animal in man is not horrible, no more than animals are horrible, for they fulfill God's will most faithfully. They live to fulfill their Creator's purpose. We do not do this, Dr. Jung continues. We meddle with the work of our Creator, for we always want to be something different from what we are. Our ambition is not to be the whole of ourselves, for that would be unpleasant, he says. The end of quote. We are not conscious of what our body wants, only what we want our body to be or do for us. I recall one woman telling me, my body is the thing that takes my head from the house to the car. And then when we are not aware of what our body wants, then we certainly will abuse it. This factor is most pointedly portrayed in a recent autobiographical story by Mary Kay Blakely. The name of the book is Wake Me When It's Over. And Mary Kay Blakely is a freelance writer. And it's almost the story of Superwoman. It tells a story of a young mother, recently divorced, trying to keep her home together with her boys, making sure they traveled 400 miles every weekend to see their father, being the so supportive, even the divorced father. Just working constantly, meeting deadlines, rushing. Constant rush. And it tells of that she went into a coma. The day before she went into the coma, she writes about rushing to the airport, lugging too much baggage for her small frame with only minutes to spare. this kind of frantic rush all the time. She gets on the plane finally. She slumps to the floor of the plane, half faint, and she begins to weep, just weep. But she knows that something is going on, but she's unable to keep it. She has been ill. She has diabetes. She has this tube in her from recent lung surgery. Still, she keeps saying, "I won't stop. I'll keep up this whatever pace I need to meet." And terrible thing. She writes that event that she evidently was trying to kill herself. She says, "In the 3 years since the separation with her husband, I had had 2 car accidents, 3 hospitalizations from mysterious diseases, and a bike accident that knocked me unconscious." And she was equally aware of the circumstances surrounding her illnesses. And she writes that when my internist speculated that my diabetes might be connected with the pulmonary X-ray shadows, diagnosing and treating one might relieve the symptoms of the other, I capitulated to exploratory surgery, she writes. But she also says, "But it violated everything I knew about the history of my highly psychosomatic, intensely sensitive body. I believe the shadows were symptoms of a great depression beginning with her brother's suicide. And I knew that the cure of depression was not surgery." But I'm bringing this point out because you see, the things that so often our psyche is trying to tell us, and if we don't listen to the psyche, it's going to come in physical symptoms, as hers were. And then to keep running, denying, avoiding, looking at the physical symptoms is also damaging to the body, but even more damaging to the psychological process. So these things about her body and her emotional life, she knew. She knew headwise. But she wouldn't stop to really do anything about it. And she'd even write notes to herself and pin them on the refrigerator. You know, she says, "Our body, start reclaiming it. Return to yoga practice. Eat well. Sleep. By all means, sleep," she says. And but still, she continued the abuse. So this is only one example, and each one of you probably know many more. One example of a very intelligent woman who knew what healing had to take place, yet in her busy, rushed-up, frantic life would not listen to what the body more than wanted, really needed, what the body needed. The body couldn't take any more abuse, and I think going into the coma was the only way to stop the mad denial of the body, and it was the only way to heal the soul. If we so strongly identify only with our body image, our persona side, or if we want only what our body can do for us, then we sadly miss the most beautiful aspects of our body. Our contact with our instinctive life, the keystone of the feminine nature, but also we miss knowing the place where our soul resides, our body. I think this obsession with the body beautiful, or body image, and the denial of the natural body is in many ways a contemporary expression of our unconscious, but in a perverted form. It is if we do seek the beauty of our being, our total being, which does encompass the soul, of course. But because there are no easy guidelines and no clear or precise direction, we just center all the attention on the body. And our culture certainly reinforces that, from Hollywood to Fifth Avenue. But what beauty treatments, if you will, do we allow the soul? How do we maintain a healthy and happy soul? Would we dare to spend billions of dollars to develop the soul? Would we resolve to spend the time and the energy required for soul making? Dr. Young wrote, quote, "A deviation from the truths of the blood begets neurotic restlessness." And we've had about enough of that these days. Restlessness begets meaninglessness. And the lack of meaning in our life is soul sickness, whose full extent and full import our age has not yet begun to comprehend. In this talk, I would like to focus on the beauty of the soul and how we may enhance its development. Paradoxically, it is the splendor of the soul that creates a countenance, a grace, a loveliness, which envelops the body in beauty. And if it is not present, then the beauty of the body is superficial or only skin deep, as the saying goes. It is also short-lived. So when we speak of soul, it is elusive to definition. In many readings of Jung, we know that he is termed soul as anima, or the unconscious feminine side of the man. Jung also refers to the woman's unconscious as animus, which relates to spirit, but he also makes the reference to the woman's soul. In his definitions found in the back of volume 6, and which was written early on in Jung's career, there is an entry for the word, in his list of definitions, there's an entry for the word psyche, and it simply says, see soul. In other places, the word soul is used to denote non-material aspects of humans, their core, their heart, or center. In Psychology and Alchemy, which is a later writing of Jung's work, he writes, "It would be blasphemy to assert that God can manifest himself everywhere save only the human soul. Indeed, the very intimacy of relationship between God and soul automatically precludes any devaluation of the latter. It would be going too far to speak of an affinity. But at all events, the soul must contain in itself the faculty of relation to God, that is a correspondence. Otherwise, a connection could never come about." End of quote. So we are left in some confusion of exactly what soul is before we even begin to see how we might relate to it. But for our purpose, let us just say that soul is that non-material aspect of the human which relates to his or her psychic reality. It is the corresponding factor of one's being with the divine. And even this definition is so inadequate, because I think the definition of soul really defies head talk. It belongs to heart talk. But if we can just kind of keep those ideas when we talk about so as we go on. In order to become conscious, more conscious of our soul, the reality of our psychic life must be carefully attended. We do not have to wait for our body to collapse or to have a nervous breakdown to be aware of our soul's response to our external daily life, our attitudes and our aspirations. Our psyche sends us daily messages, or rather nightly messages, really even faster than a fax machine. It's certainly more interesting. These messages are our dreams. Another quote from Dr. Jung, he says, in each of us there is another whom we do not know. He speaks to us in dreams and tells us how differently he sees us from the way we see ourselves. When, therefore, we find ourselves in a difficult situation to which there is no solution, he can sometimes kindle a light that radically alters our attitude, the very attitude that led us into a difficult situation. And that's the end of the quote. In early Greek culture, when those who were ill came to the temple of Asclepius, the god of healing, they were ushered in, and the body was attended to with warm baths and soothing oils. And then the patient, the one who was ill, was laid to rest in a place in which he could sleep. And when he awakened, there was a priest of Asclepius sitting by his bedside to talk about his dreams. So in the early Greek times, the healing had to contain both. Healing belonged to both the body and the soul, the psychic life. I would like to tell you about two young women, both very beautiful, both highly intelligent. They were both living on a fast track, climbing the corporate ladder, doing very well in our collective thoughts. Neither had married, but each led a very active sex life, however, not a love life. Each came into analysis because of depression, and I was not surprised to find that each experienced dysmenorrhea or amenorrhea monthly. This is usually a really first sign of that a woman is living against her soul being when there is difficulty with her monthly periods. They exercised regularly and were compulsive about dieting, but only because it enhanced their body image. Now, I want to tell you their dreams. This is the first woman's dream. I am delighted to find a box of newborn kittens. But on closer inspection, when I stop to pick them up, I find they are starving and covered with feces. And as we know, the cat is associated with the feminine nature. And with this young woman, some aspect of the feminine nature had been born, that is, made conscious to her. But as you can see, the dream maker, that person that lives in her she did not know, was telling her that this aspect of the feminine had not been nurtured or cared for. It was starving. And not only that, it was contaminated. This is the second woman's dream. I shall call her Alice Brown. I'm walking up the path to a strange new house, and I have some reason for going there. On the path, I am stopped by a repulsive sight of a little dog who had been beaten and cut. There was blood all about, and its organs were exposed. The dog looks up at me and says, "Don't hurt me. My name is Alice Brown." And here again we see the symbol of one's instinctive life, one's animal life that has been cruelly abused. This is body, but more than body, it's her identity, her name. The strange new house at the end of the path perhaps denotes a new psychic house, which is her destination. But first she must be consciously aware of her deviation from the truth of the blood, as Jung said, and heal her instinctive nature. Over a period of time, both women did heed the messages of their dreams. They did something about it. One changed professions. The other found a new way to work within her profession. And they became very, very conscious of what their body was telling them, what their dreams were telling them, and began to live a more fruitful and fulfilling life. They follow their nature's course into heart's desire instead of ego's or intellect's desire. The utterances of the heart, unlike the discriminating intellect, always relates to the whole. This was not without suffering or sacrifice in some ways, or is anything that we do important without some cost. But actually, it's cost to the ego. Dr. Jung says that suffering is not an illness. It is a normal counterpole to happiness. And in another place, Jung said, neurosis is always a substitute for legitimate suffering. You hear that one again? Neurosis is always the substitute for legitimate suffering. That said, these women did not follow the neurotic path. They listened to their dreams and they met their soul's challenge, and in doing so, really brought in a more fulfilling life. Another way of, quote, exercising our soul is reflection or meditation. These are also remedies of soul making. And it should be understood as simply an act. It should not be understood as simply an act of thought or ruminating over a specific event. The word reflection literally means to bend backward. And Jung considers this a spiritual act. Reflection is a way of stopping and calling something to mind, forming a picture, and we take a relation to this picture and come to terms with it. It should also be understood as an act of making soul content more conscious. There is a danger, however, in becoming too reflective or too introspective. And I am reminded of an Analysand's dream, which warned her of this. And this is her dream. At a pet shop, I have bought some beautiful iridescent tadpoles and several little puppies. I was to keep the tadpoles for myself. The puppies I was to keep for a little while only, as they were to be gifts for others. At home, I placed the tadpoles in a beautiful aquarium and was fascinated in watching them. Their beautiful colors, all about them, almost to the point of being mesmerized. The puppies were bothering me. They were chewing up everything and messing on the floor. I did not like cleaning up after them. I really did not want to waste my time with the puppies when I could be watching my tadpoles. That was the end of the dream. So the tadpoles belong to those unconscious contents which we do find so fascinating times. They live in the sea of the unconscious, you see, and their iridescence quality and how they, the metamorphosis that they undertake, it captures us to the extent that we forget all about these messy little puppies over here. Now, remember, the messy little puppies were the gifts to others. And when I asked her what her association to puppies were, well, she says, you know, happiness is a warm puppy. So we forget about that sense of human warmth and what this little puppy is, and even though it looks so messy at times. So this is a danger where we must do a sense of reflection or meditation, but not to become so involved that we forget the warm puppy aspect of our lives and bringing those parts of our unconscious out when it is time into the lives of other people. Active imagination is closely related to reflection. In contrast to dreaming, which is experienced passively, active imagination engages the unconscious by an active and creative participation of the ego. Jung described the process as dreaming with open eyes. In active imagination, one concentrates on a specific point, a mood, picture, or event, and then allows a change of associated fantasies to develop and gradually take on dramatic character. Thereafter, the images have a life of their own and develop according to their own logic. These are characters which people are unconscious. They are unknown aspects of ourselves, of our own being. A beautiful example of active imagination is found in Jung's autobiographical work, Memory Streams and Reflections. And in the chapter Confrontation with the Unconscious, he writes and describes the character Philemon, the lame-footed yet winged spirit, who represented to him superior insight. And this is what he writes about active imagination. In my fantasies, I held conversations with him, Philemon. And he said things which I had not consciously thought, for I observed clearly that it was he who spoke and not I. End of quote. So in doing active imagination, the ego must be open to what it sees, in quotes, or hears. Not hallucinations, but what comes up, you see. Conscious doubt must be overcome. If something inside of you wants to respond and then you say, that's so silly, I can't say that. It's really, it's not me. Or try to make up something that sounds very, very erudite or something. Actually, Jung had to struggle with this too. For he states that when writing these experiences with Philemon and the other characters of the unconscious, he asked himself, what am I really doing? Certainly this has nothing to do with science, he said to himself. So he had this doubt that crept in too. course, he was just inventing it as he went along, you see. But he knew with his work with Philemon that you can actively participate in the unconscious life if you listen very carefully to see what it wants to respond to you, how it wants to respond to you. And then do an act of imagination. Many people write down if it's dialogue or draw the images that they see. Some people dance it out, play it out, to make it more concrete, become much more conscious. We can keep it better, you see. It's going to float away. And again, there are hazards. As with any good exercise, it can also be overdone. And as with tadpole watching, we become so fascinated with our inner life that we neglect the confrontation with our outer life. And it also should be noted that in doing active imagination, the unconscious contents possess a great deal of energy, higher level of energy, and that when afforded an outlet, they can take possession of the personality, and a real inflation can result. Usually, when I do active imagination, or when I tell my analysands about the process of doing active imagination, the suggestion that I make is to first limit the time that they do practice active imagination, and then afterwards do a very menial job, like weeding the garden or washing the dishes or cleaning the toilet, really. And that's to ground you real completely, real fast, you see. It's to get into it and move into it with the active imagination of confrontation with the other side, but also ground yourself here. Another exercise for soul-making is becoming more conscious of the eternal child which dwells within. The eternal child is the soul child, which was present at our birth and is personal, yet it also has roots in the archetype of the divine child, which is transpersonal. Dr. Jung writes, quote, "In every adult there lurks a child, an eternal child, something that is always becoming and is never completed and calls for unceasing care, attention, and education. That is the part of the human personality that wants to develop and to become whole, but the man of today is far indeed from this wholeness," end quote. We often find this child in dreams. He or she is in a closet or the basement or an attic, stuffed away somewhere. He or she is a waif or the abandoned child. How strong and how universal this image is can be realized if you recall your emotional reaction to the film E.T. Yeah, our eternal child was projected right up on the silver screen. It was an alien, and it wanted to go home. So when we think of our soul child in the same terms, in our neglect, it has become alien to us, and it desperately wants to come home, the soul. We have lost touch with the warm puppy way of loving and accepting. We have lost the spontaneity and wonderment of childhood. We have lost that touch with our inner being, our imaginal world, in the process of becoming very rational, responsible adults, you see. So how can we reclaim our soul child so that we may give it unceasing care and attention and the education it needs? In a recent film, Shirley Valentine, a protagonist of the story, was able to reconnect to the young girl she used to know, although she had to take some very drastic measures. Do any of you know that film, Shirley Valentine? It's wonderful. And those who don't, you know it. Yeah. I do suggest those that you don't, that don't know it, it's on videotape and you can rent it. And so we'll talk a little bit about it now, and then if you have a chance to see it, it'd be nice. It is a story about a middle-aged housewife whose children were grown, and you see her doing the daily chores of shopping and cleaning and cooking. And there is a desperate sameness about her life as she is expected to do this on a Thursday night and this on a Tuesday night, and if she gets it mixed up, then her husband has trouble with that and so forth. She wore her skirts too short, and she'd smoke cigarettes when she wasn't supposed to, and she would do everything that she could to defy this rigid authority, you see. Just full of spirit. But the character of the grown-up Shirley Valentine was not like that. She was kind of a dull housewife, is what she was. And she went around talking to herself all the time, kind of like an ongoing active imagination, you see. And then one day she had a chance to go to Greece with her friend. And she said, well, she couldn't possibly do this, even though it was the place of her dreams, and all the things that she couldn't. And then finally she gave in, she went. And it wasn't a trip to Greece. It was her journey. It really was an individuating type of journey. And she leaves the old person behind. In fact, when the time came, when the holiday was over, and time to return back to her old surroundings, she and her old identity, she chose not to, and she chose to remain in Greece. And at one point of the film, she was sitting by the calm and beautiful sea, reflecting all the colors of the sunset. She called the sea as deep as forever. The waters as deep as forever. This magnificent scene that you kind of thought was kind of what Shirley portrayed Shirley Valentine herself, you see, this deepness of who she was, and yet the reflection of the sunset of her years right there. So she's talking to herself, and we hear her say to herself, I've led such a little life, and even that life could be over soon. I could allow myself to lead this little life that goes on inside of me, but there's so much more. But it's all gone unused. And now it will never be. Why do we get all this life if we don't use it? Why do we get all these dreams and hopes if we don't ever use it? I think Shirley Valentine is all right. She just got lost in all this unused life. And there was also this wonderful dialogue between the frantic calls her husband made and the reclaimed Shirley Valentine. And you can hear the soul-searching that which had transpired in Shirley. Of course, the husband accused her of having a holiday romance, and to which Shirley responds, the only holiday romance I've had is with myself. And I think I've come to like myself. I think I'm all right. I haven't fallen in love with a man. I've fallen in love with the idea of living. And the husband, truly caring and trying to be helpful, but ever so rational, he says to her, "Don't you know what you're going through? You're going through the change of life." And then Shirley responds very quietly, but very specifically. She says, "Yes, Joe, a change of life." And at the end of the picture, Shirley is waiting by her seaside table with a glass of wine, and she's waiting for Joe's coming also to Greece to get her. But in this solid way, we know that who she is, she's very much her own person now. And in her caring way, she muses, I hope he will stay for a little while. He needs to feel the sun on his skin and be in the water that's deepest forever. So when Joe arrives and he kind of passes her by, and so she calls out to him and says, "Hey, Joe." And he turns around and he says, "I didn't recognize you." He was really shocked. And she says, "I know. I used to be mother and wife, but now I'm Shirley again." So this is a contemporary story of how one woman found her lost child in herself. Now, it's not to suggest that we all hop the next plane to Greece, you see. It'd be nice. But it might not be our way. It really might not. But we do have a way when we take time to explore those early memories, those desires, those heart utterances which were whispered by our eternal child. And once we have explored that unused life, then we must take steps to integrate it. A woman's dream told of this. It was a very short one, but a very powerful one. In the dream, that a mother, the Virgin Mary, appeared to her and was holding her infant son, the divine child. And with this dream came very much emotion, of course, as you can well imagine. And it came as quite a surprise because the patient was not of the Roman Catholic faith, nor was she even very active in the faith that she did choose to belong. So the dream presented a profound dilemma because, as she told me, I don't know how to truly honor the Virgin and the Divine Child. And I suggested that perhaps in act of imagination, she could ask the Virgin how she may honor her and her child. And it took several weeks to get up the nerve to begin to approach this and to maintain an appropriate attitude toward this. She did ask the Virgin how she could honor her and the Divine Child, and the Virgin responded to her, "You can honor me by celebrating your one." And that is quite a switch from our Christian doctrine. Quite a switch. To honor the deity is not just a reverence to the deity, but must include a celebration of one's own life. "One cannot live from anything except what one is," Jung wrote. And it is the life that the soul child brings at birth, the intrinsic life which we are, that is to be celebrated, a life not to go unused. This is turning to our soul child, to our eternal child. Last summer on public radio, the speech by the Dalai Lama and maybe some of you have heard it, the tapes of that. And much what he said pertains to what we're talking about in our exercising of the soul. However, he used a much more colorful phrase, much more poetic way of expressing it. He called it the good heart. And some of his remarks, at least a few that I was able to jot down, I think are applicable here. He said that even amid the world's chaos, the larger percentage of people know and give human affection, and the majority of humanity is gentle. The main force in humanity is affection. And that he related that the obstacle of the good heart is anger. Anger is the inner enemy, and it destroys the happiness and future. Anger is blind and is self-destructive. And he says that to develop the good heart takes a determined force of mind, but in realizing one's individual strengths, we can help humanity become more mature. And I am reminded again in what the Dalai Lama had to say of Jung's writings, which are, but God himself cannot flourish if man's soul is starved. Human affection is part and partial of soul making. And again, this is the writing by James Hillman. And he says, reflection may make consciousness, but love makes soul. Our friend, the natural body, is an absolutely essential in this aspect of soul making. Have you hugged your child today? It's just not a catchy bumper sticker. It has a deeper meaning. The love, the warmth of a human soul is delivered to another by a hug, a kiss, a sweet embrace. The soul message of another is received first by our body, and then it touches our heart. I recall a story of how people who were interned in the concentration camps fed and nourished a dying soul of another prisoner whose inner life was dimming. Four or five people would stretch out, and they would just sit in a row like so, and then they would lay this person over their lap, and then they would lean over them. So the person was completely enveloped in by warmth or by a body, you see. And they would stay that way for as long as it took, that it was as if the soul's energy was transmitted to another through the body. And there is a power there that defies really our rational mind. We can't understand it. Nevertheless, the healing power of the soul's love is there. What the heart hears is the wisdom of the soul. Once more, I refer to the book of Mary Carey Bakley that she said when she said, the coma lasted and lasted and lasted, as she was told, and she eventually came out of it. And what happened to seemingly bring her out of it, was certainly not the medical care that she was getting, it was a lot of that. But her friends, her loved ones, her family, all throughout the nation, all networked, and at a certain time, on a specific time, everyone at the same time began to send love messages to her through their heart. Concentrated effort, and within a few hours after this, she did come out of the coma. The death knows truly what does transpire and all that. We do know it's very powerful. Our psychic life, our soul's life, also depends on the body to express love and sexual intercourse. And the term lovemaking is not just idle expression, but when taken literally, it means just that, lovemaking. How different the meaning is from that of having sex, even though the act is manifested in the same way. Sexuality is not mere instinctuality. It contains the creative power of Eros. Jung writes of this superhuman power. Eros is a mighty daemon. We shall never get the better of him or only to our own hurt. And he is not the whole of our inward nature, though he is at least one of its essential aspects. The shared experience of lovemaking, where there are similar aims of allowing not only the body's instinctual nature, but also the soul's spiritual nature to be experienced with another, strengthens the feeling of unity and identity. It is, in truth, as Jung said, the genuine and incontestable experience of the divine, whose transcendent force obliterates and consumes everything individual. A real communion with life and the impersonal power of fate. Now that we have some idea of the beautiful qualities of our body, not simply body image, and the wonderment of our soul, how do we get the two living together harmoniously? Each giving life to the other. And of course, this is just a question from ages and ages ago. And it was the part of the philosopher's quest in their alchemical search. Dorn, who was a 14th century physician, was also a student of Paracelsus, the alchemist of Jung, which Jung writes so about. Jung's writings are like an act of imagination also, where the mind and the soul and the body journey together to the castle of philosophical love to find how they may be united. Understandably, as a physician, Dorn's approach to alchemy is more explicit in how the individuation process relates to the physical. And he writes, "I am not teaching you how to make gold for money, but how to find the most simple medicine, the remedy by which you can cure the sick metals of the body with metaphysical metals, and how to find the physical philosopher's stone through which the metaphysical metals transform the sick metals of the body into the perfect Eurasian metals." And this term Eurasian metals refers to the idea of the substance being of the body being restored to its original state, the form that they were at creation. Dorn continues, "Thus when the body consents to join in, everything comes together in harmony and moderation, and there is this ethereal substance, a balsamic substance, in our body, which also preserves it in a healthy form." So unlike the early ascetics, of whom we know purged their body by flagellation or fasting or even castration in order to achieve a higher level of spiritual life, Dorn did not view the spiritualization by throwing out earthy man. He knew of metaphysical medicine, as he called it, innate within which was necessity for life and health and emotional and physical well-being. Fairy tales teach us the same lesson, and I'm thinking of one in particularly, Beauty and the Beast. Beauty we could think of as a soul child, beautiful yet innocent. she wants only a rose, a gift from the Father, a symbolic gift of love for the spiritual factor. As as there is no mother in our story, and the mother relates to matter, those words kind of stem from the same root, mater. Beauty, or the soul, is not grounded in matter. It is suspended, or we could say abstract. There is an innocence about this abstract soul. One can moon about it, or even float around talking about it, or even appear rather mystical about it, you see. But soul needs matter, or body, to ground it, so that we can sense it as a reality. And so as our fairy tale would have it, and also our individuation process decrees it, beauty must go to live with the beast because the father stole the rose from the beast's garden. And here, the father tried to steal from Eros the rose. He should have heeded Jung's words that we can never get the best of Eros, or only to our own hurt. But after the castle of the beast, beauty is very comfortable. All her needs are attended to with luxurious care. Yet she is abhorrent of the beast, this horrible animal creature. Although he is kind and gentle, he acts in strange and inexplicable ways. The beast, of course, is our body, our physical desires and emotions, and all the other embarrassing things. Our ego would like to think that we are above all that. When Beauty was asked by the beast if she would marry him, her constant reply was no. In other words, I will not unite with her, with this thing. As if she would simply be serving a prison term, being confined by the beast. And we often think in the same terms. If I could only be free of this dreadful beast of a body, then my soul could soar back to my spiritual father. In time, however, Beauty gradually appreciates the loveliness of the sensuous experience in the beast's castle, the taste of the delicious food and wine, the hearing of the melodious music, the visual beauty of the expansive countryside, the fragrant aroma of the vast flower gardens, and the smoothness of the silken fabrics as it touched her skin. These were all made possible by the beast. These are the pleasurable, sensuous gifts our body provides for us. Beauty now developed a feeling for the beast, and she could allow him to drink cool water from cupped hands, and she would cradle his beastly head in her lap. And she began to have compassion for him. Now, as things in our life must change in order to find some resolution, it also happens in our tale. Beauty's father became ill, and Beauty was allowed to return to his side for a week. When telling her father the virtues of the beast, her tears turned to diamonds, and she knew the value that she held the beast in. He was dying, for he could not live without a soul. And Beauty immediately transports herself magically back to the beast's castle, and in finding him, her heart is filled with love. And it is the love which breaks the curse which been placed on the beast. And he becomes the prince he rightfully is. And in the story, it tells of their marriage, of the former beast and the beauty. And it is the uniting of the two, and they're transported to a new kingdom where they find great happiness. So that's all well and good, you say. That can happen in fairy tales where the body and the soul come together. Yeah, but what about real life now? How do we get the body and the soul to live together harmoniously and happy? And I think it can be done, and it's done in many ways. This is one woman's dream. Tells about it in a dream. The dream is this. I'm excited and planning on going somewhere. And it soon will be time to bathe in preparation to go. I stand outside my residence where I live now. It is on the ground floor, and the floor inside is smooth earth. There's a small patch of concrete inside where I park my car. I realize that I am the same ego, whether in my dream life or in my waking life, and I will soon step over into my waking life. That's the end of the dream, and with that, she awakens. In the preparation to go somewhere, there is a ritual bath, a baptism of cleansing and purifying. The place where she resides is close to the earth. It's not her actual house, of course. But this is the place where she resides, you see, psychologically, very close to the earth. She's well grounded, in other words. Her car, psychic libido, psychic energy, is also housed here. It is protected from external elements and is readily available. The place she is going is not a geographical place. It is a place of development. And there is a realization that her dream life or her psyche or soul life is the same as her waking life or her body's life. She is at one with herself. Her body are united in the same ego. There's another way to find this unity, and I quote once again from the alchemist Dorn. He says, written in the 14th century, if you can imagine, everyone should within himself consider carefully what I have said before about finding the physical philosopher's stone with metaphysical metals, and should taste it again and again, like drinking it again and again, and should carry it around with an honest mind. Then slowly, certain sparks will come. From day to day, they will come alive in a light before in the inner mental eyes. And slowly, those sparks will coalesce into such a light that in time, one will always know what one needs and will thus only be attached to that inner truth by which great tranquility and great quietness of mind are acquired. And I think perhaps those that have comments and questions and or would like to join in the discussion, because I hope that we all will. If you will come up and use this one, or can we hook the other one up too, to have two? Well, anyway, so that we all can hear. During the break that I did, here's some comments that we were a few talking up here in discussion, and just kind of brainstorming about how are ways in which we know that we can begin to practice getting body and soul together. There you are. Tell us about the dance that you were. Would you tell us, all of us?
I was sharing with Nancy and others that I had taking a Eurythmy class, which is essentially a movement class where you relate to space and become really aware of become aware of space and your relationship to it and your relationship to individuals and groups of people. And some of the exercises that we experienced were moving in a large ballroom and intuitively as a group essentially coming to creating forms of which we just created out of our unconscious and in a very collective way. And this particular work is based upon Rudolf Steiner's work. So it was just a really wonderful experience.
Others of you that have experienced any way of working, early on, Jung did mention dance also, movement of letting the beat, the rhythm of the body be heard, and to move with its internal rhythm, internal beat. I was recently at a woman's workshop in the desert in Arizona about 2 weeks ago. Beth was there. We did drumming and rattling and reached some real kind of primitive places and began to move with those, you see, in completely different ways than I had experienced before. Who else has had? Yeah, this gentleman back here. And it is very, very sad of commentary about our way of life in which we have been taught. We have been taught to forget. We have been taught not to let our body, to live from here up and not trust our body's senses, really. Other questions or comments that things that just were kind of spinning around during the talk or maybe outside where you were talking among yourselves? Yeah, I think it was the image of the sacred prostitute that really, really made me understand or helped me to understand the beauty of the body. To see her image, and we might play with this image tomorrow when you ask if we were doing any experiential things, and we probably will do some imagery around the sacred prostitute. She is an image to me that unites both the spiritual aspect and the sexual aspect. And of course, this is held within the body. So it's her image truly that brought me to understand how fantastic truly our body is, and that it is. I don't know about a man because I can't speak for them, but I do know for a woman that it has to be that her whole understanding of her spiritual being is connected with her instinctual life. That to me is what the sacred prostitute represents for the woman. So, yes, I can't, after knowing her image, that she, how she led me to understand that part of where, if I am to know anything about my psychic life, I have to understand and be in my body first. My definition of the sacred prostitute. Well, she, first of all, she is, she historically really was. She did exist, and she was, by definition, the votary of the goddess of love. She was the priestess of the goddess of love. And she enacted the sexual act in the temple of love and as a worship to the goddess of love. So that's who she was historically. Now my definition, kind of psychologically, is she belongs to several different realms, I think, you know, for, as I've just talked about what she is to the woman. For the man, she is that she belongs to an aspect of the anima, the man's soul guide, but it's the, it's not the feminine that's the maternal, but it's the feminine who is the dynamic part that, which moves and creates the zest for life, you see. She animates the man. She is not the seductress, but quite the opposite. She brings man into the realization of his own kind of the sense of love and how that feminine reaction there, the relatedness that she brings to him. I also see her in another way as an aspect of the self, as she is related to the goddess and as she is part that aspect of the divine. Yes. Right. Yeah, and actually both of those things are linked together because in our image, our idealization of what we think a man is, that which we project onto the external man, is the aspects of our own animus. You see, that part of ourselves that we do not realize. It's unconscious in us. Now, our animus, or the masculine side of us, is formed by men who have been very instrumental in our early life. They bring us the actual image. It helps form what we say our personal animus is. Animus itself is very archetypal, you see, it's man, but then we have our own personal picture of that. And as you said, these are the men you happen to fall in love with, you see. You project this image onto these and specific kind of man. Why this man and not this man? And it does, and it somehow falls back on the imagery in which we learn man as. You know, whether it comes from my father, a significant older man in our life when we were young, a mentor, a brother figure, some hero, even a book character, those type of things. The women that have fallen in love with Elvis Presley and now voting on a stamp, you see. Now, that image has to come from somewhere. I mean, you think of all of the energy that was around that, you see.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.